So I'm talking with a return visit with Amita Sehgal, who is a sleep researcher at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School and a Howard Hughes medical investigator, and is here for a meeting in San Diego at the Society for Cell Biology.
That's right.
So let's do a continuation of where we were when we last talked at Sleep Seattle 2009, and see what's happened since then, see if the problem of sleep can be completely solved. But maybe first, what are you presenting here?
So the cell biology meeting, I'm presenting some of our circadian rhythm work. So we've been looking at the circadian regulation of metabolism. And we find that there, in the fly, there are clocks in neurons and clocks in the fat body, which is like the fly liver, that regulate a rhythm of feeding and that also control nutrient storage.
So how does that work? I mean, what's the finding?
The finding is that there is a circadian clock in the fat body that typically promotes the storage of nutrients like glycogen and triglycerides. And so, you know, the animals have enough of this, they don't need to eat that much, and they're well equipped to survive periods of starvation. Clocks in neurons, on the other hand, promote the utilization of these resources, probably because neurons need a lot of metabolic input. And so the two work in opposing directions to control metabolic activity.
Okay, now this is interesting. Many years ago, people, when they talked about circadian rhythms and a clock, they were talking about a clock.
I know.
In the suprachiasmatic nucleus.
Right. That's right.
And that was it.
Right.
Then suddenly there's a proliferation of clocks. We can have a whole clock shop.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
Could you describe that whole setup for us so I get a better sense of this?
So it is true that the one clock that was known to exist in mammals was in the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is in the hypothalamus, and everybody thought that every circadian function would be attributable to that clock. When clock genes were cloned, and they were cloned first in Drosophila and then in mammals, one of the things that was found was that they're expressed in a lot of tissues outside the suprachiasmatic nucleus, outside the brain. And so in fact, in my talk today, I showed a slide where you're looking at PER, the clock protein PER, expressed in flies as visualized with the GFP.
PER is short for period.
PER is short for the period, which is a clock gene,
right.
And it's fused to green fluorescent protein. And so you're looking at, you know, green fluorescent protein expression in the fly, and the whole fly lights up. The point being that, you know, period is expressed all over.
Right.
Yeah. And so anyway, so looking carefully at these different places that these clock genes are expressed, what was found was that these genes are cycling and they're creating local clocks in many different body tissues.
Now, is that because you need local assaying to effectively respond to environmental conditions?
So that's a good question as to why they have their own clocks, okay? And I can only speculate here. So one possibility is that you just get a more robust rhythm if you have a local clock driving it, as opposed to, you know, getting these third-hand signals from the brain. You know, they're going through a humoral factor and neural connection. So here you have a clock that's right there. The other thing, which is an interesting point you raised, is that it may be that these clocks can respond to signals that may be more relevant for that particular tissue.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm talking about here is that in mammals, the clock in the liver can be set by feeding. So the time of feeding will determine the time of the clock in the liver, but not the brain. So if you feed animals at the wrong time of day, you can actually desynchronize these internal clocks, because the brain clock will still be running with the speed that was set, or not the speed, but with the time that was set by the light dark cycle, and the liver clock will be going with the timing of feeding.
Translate that, if you would, into somebody getting up in the morning, going to work, what is happening to their metabolism in terms of what you've just described?
Okay, so assuming that what has been described in rodents by people is true in humans, then a person who is eating at the right time of day has all the clocks synchronized. On the other hand, if you are eating in the middle of the night or at, you know, odd times, then what you may be doing is changing the timing of your liver clock so that such that it is no longer synchronized with your brain clock. And we don't yet know what the consequences of such desynchrony are. But I think it's safe to say that it's probably not good for you.
Okay, now when you say eating at the right time,
So,
what's the right time?
Okay, so for humans, we don't really know. Nobody's really shown what the rhythm is. I'm just basing it on the time that we normally eat. With rodents and with flies, for instance, we know that there's a rhythm of feeding. So flies, for instance, eat usually most early in the morning after they wake up.
Right.
And so for them, the wrong time would be at night.
Okay, so most of the what your grandmother told you advice, have a good breakfast in the morning.
Yes,
and
yes.
Those are probably, the intuitive things are probably correct.
They are probably correct.
So the idea is to not get these huge spikes of
insulin. Right. And you know, my guess is that a lot of what happens with jet lag is this desynchrony between clocks, because they may reset at different rates to the new light drug cycle. And then meantime, again, you're eating at odd times.
Now, you've done some work on jet lag fruit flies.
Yes.
Right.
So we actually identified a molecule which we called jet lag. And we named it that because when it's mutated, the flies have trouble adjusting to a new light drug cycle. So in flies, we typically name a gene after its mutant phenotype.
Right.
Okay, yeah. So the flies that don't have the jet lag protein have extended jet lag. And so what this particular protein does is it helps the flies adapt to new light drug cycles. And the reason it does that is because it is involved in the degradation of a clock protein, timeless, by light. And the degradation of timeless by light is what resets the clock.
Okay, now, I asked you before, when we talked about fruit flies and sleeping, how do you know they're sleeping? Some very basic questions.
Right.
How do you jet lag a fruit fly?
So the jet lag stuff is actually easier to describe with the fruit fly than is the sleep, believe it or not. So we've known for many, many years, even before we just showed a sleep state in flies, that flies had rest activity rhythms. Right? So very robust rest activity cycles. When you keep them in a light drug cycle, they have morning and evening peaks of activity. When you move them to a different light dark cycle, you now have to shift those morning and evening peaks of activity. In a wild type fly, in a normal fly, it'll take a few days for the fly to have stable morning and evening activity peaks. In a jet lag mutant, it'll take even longer.
Okay. So is there an implication, is there any advice there for how we go about our business of trying to get over jet lag?
I don't think that we can use any of our work to predict how you could get over jet lag, other than to say that bright light would be good. The more...
So the advice about... I remember talking to Chuck Seifer about
Yes, and
this.
I'm sure he says that, yes.
Long
and it
time
makes
ago,
it makes sense.
When you get to the new place,
go get bright
get
light.
Get onto the clock.
Yeah. And it makes sense because, for instance, this mutant that I'm talking about is not completely insensitive to light, it's just less sensitive. And so with more bright light, it's more likely to adapt.
Yeah. Now, you know that we're also doing some work, a meeting down the line on diet, nutrition, metabolism, aging, staying alive. You've talked about the jet lag story, you've talked about the recent paper, the work you presented this morning, there are some implications with stress that I've read that you've done as well.
Right, so that has to do with sleep deprivation, right?
Right, and so I'm actually looking at a paper that just came out in the PNAS, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, that I want to use as a jumping off point to get some information from you. This is a paper from UC San Francisco, glucocorticoid regulation. The circadian clock modulates glucose homeostasis. Let's unpack that. What we're really talking about there is daily rhythms and stress, which produces glucocorticoids. And in terms of glucose, glucose homeostasis. We're talking about keeping a stable metabolism, fundamentally. But can you sort of talk us through this part of it?
Right. So I think what the paper is talking about is the fact that the clock controls glucose homeostasis because it's controlling glucose metabolism at multiple levels. And a clock protein itself, or a clock gene, PER2 in this case, is regulated, is activated by the glucocorticoid receptor. And so that is how glucocorticoids would reset the clock, which in turn then would control.
So what I'm making here is a connection between diet, stress, and sleep. And
right. So
not necessarily diet, but I'm talking about
That's what I was thinking of. It's not necessarily diet.
Metabolism. Right. But this is all part of when you're eating as well. When the stress comes in and so on.
So when the stress comes in.
People get stressed, they go and eat things.
Mm-hmm.
This ends up with the liver clocks getting out of whack and so on. So isn't there a connection here?
In this particular case, so let's see, if the glucocorticoids are turning on, if you're stressed, you are affecting the clock. Okay, yeah, I can see that. And that might change the time of sleep, assuming that you're resetting the clock in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Because the thing is, and I think that's true of that paper, the glucocorticoids are resetting the clock in the peripheral tissue,
mm-hmm.
and which means that the brain clock might be unaffected, as it is unaffected by feeding as well. And if the brain clock is unaffected, then the time of sleep may or may not change.
Now, of course, it
may change also because in some of those restrictive feeding paradigms, the brain clock doesn't change, but the timing of activity changes because the animal anticipates the arrival of food.
Yeah.
Maybe this is getting too complicated here, but yeah.
Well, no, I'm not trying to push you into mm-hmm. saying things mm-hmm. just for the sake of saying
right.
things because
I'm
trying, I suppose, to highlight the fact of how difficult it can be as you have a bill going through.
Right.
As you have all this talk
right.
about medical costs,
right.
as I read papers in the New York Times
right.
about corporate CEOs now deciding that they should really inform their workers more about their diets
right.
and so on and so forth, because
right.
if they're eating bad diets and
mm-hmm.
screwing up their metabolism, then it's costing the company money, which is da 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 da, etc. It's this huge ball
of
stuff there. But to explain to people, the actual people involved here,
mm-hmm.
what is actually happening and the complexities of this is kind of tough. I mean,
because most of those people and most of those
clocks there are.
They're not taking clocks into consideration at all.
Right.
I don't think. Yeah. I mean, they're talking about quality of food and stuff. They're not talking about timing.
Well, so shouldn't we be?
Yes, we absolutely should be.
And what would you be advising people?
I would
have corporate cafeterias and so on about
I would be saying that, first of all, I think more research needs to be done to look at what the consequences of, aberrant eating habits might be. But that is an important consideration, and that a lot of the metabolic problems that people have these days may be coming not just because of the type of food they're eating, but the time at which they're eating.
One of the things that came up recently, this paper of yours from PLOS-1.
Right.
The title again, I'll just read the title. So what we're talking about, energy stores are not altered by long-term partial sleep deprivation in fruit fly, in Drosophila.
Right.
That sounds counterintuitive. Energy stores are not altered by long-term sleep deprivation. You think that sleep deprivation was, by definition, bad,
yes.
and therefore
they would be altered.
There would be depletion of energy stores or something like that.
So the prediction.
As a naive reader, put it that way.
Right. No. So the prediction, based upon the human studies, was that lipids, triglycerides, would go up. And that relates to this, there were a couple of reports a few years ago, and actually probably more since then, that the obesity epidemic in this country may be due to partial sleep deprivation, sleep restriction. People,
right.
You know, people are chronically sleep deprived.
Right.
And the people who are chronically sleep deprived have high BMI and high, you know, fat storage and so forth.
Right.
So we decided to model this in the fly.
Right.
And so we deprived flies of sleep over a 1 week or more period, a few hours of sleep every night.
Right.
And we looked at these nutrients. And we found, okay, with one form of sleep deprivation, so we tried different methods of sleep deprivation. And one method we used was mechanical, where, you know, the flies are basically kind of, they get a jolt periodically at night, and so they're not able to sleep. And we're monitoring their activity, so we know they're not sleeping. And so we did that, and with the mechanical sleep deprivation, we actually saw exactly what the human studies had reported, which was that there was an increase in triglycerides. However, the control we do typically for that type of experiment is to apply the same mechanical stimulation where you kind of, you know, just move the flies around, but do it at a time of day when they're not deprived of sleep. So you do it during the day. Typically flies sleep at night. So when you deprive them of sleep, you apply the mechanical stimulation at night.
And this is the shaking.
This is the shaking, basically, yeah. And so we did the shaking during the day, and we found that we got the same effect. So we conclude, and then we tried other methods of deprivation, like just leaving the light on at night, and we didn't see an effect on triglycerides. So we concluded that the reason that the mechanical stimulation was giving us an increase in triglycerides was not because the flies had lost sleep, but because they were stressed out by the stimulation. Because we got the same effect when we applied the stimulation and did not deprive them. So, I mean, I think that is something to keep in mind, even with the human studies, is they're not dissociating the effect of stress from the effect of sleep deprivation. And it may be that the people who are sleep deprived are stressed for any number of reasons.
Which took me back to the glucocorticoid
story. Yes, yes, yeah.
Because so I assume that if you're shaking yourself.
Yes, so if they're stressed, right, so glucocorticoids, let's say, are activated, they're resetting the clock. We don't know if any of the effects we saw are going through the clock, but, you know, this paper would suggest that they could be.
So it's still, we had this conversation before, it's remarkable that something that we all do all the time,
right,
is still, almost in a state of infancy, sleep research.
Right, oh, sleep research is very much in a state of infancy. I think it, you know, it wasn't taken seriously as a hard science for a long time, by many neuroscientists.
Yes, we talked about that last time. So, and this comes to the fore now. Sometimes these things only really manifest when you also have a technological leap as well. In other words, I was this last week across the street at UC San Diego with Jacopo Annese, who was slicing, sectioning the brain of the famous amnesic patient, HM.
Uh-huh.
And it occurred to me that the major paper about HM's brain that was done by Brendan Milner and so on was 1957.
What's that?
50 years ago.
Yeah, wow.
And this is really the beginning of understanding in a serious fashion what's going on. Remember, but you have this leap in technology.
Yes.
You've got stuff that can look in brains,
right,
and things that can
properly slice brains,
so on. So perhaps with sleep research and all its concomitant problems, like the dietary issues, the metabolic issues, and so on, maybe the advances in technology have been needed.
But in the case of sleep research, I don't think it was a technological advance. I think it was the fact that genes were isolated that affected sleep. I'm not considering that a technological, I'm considering it more of a conceptual advance, but yeah.
So you mean post-1953, sort of Craig Watson and the whole DNA?
Well, in case of sleep, you know, the genes that got a lot of attention were the narcolepsy genes, right?
Right.
Which was published in 1999. And it was at that point that people, you know, realized that they didn't just have to I mean, maybe it's overstating it to say that people didn't realize until then, but certainly after that point, people knew that there was a genetics of sleep to be learned. There was a molecular biology, and so it should be approached with those tools.
Could you also talk about this? I just mentioned memory and,
right.
and HM and so
right.
on. You did a preview of a couple of other papers
right.
in Cell
right.
just earlier in October
right.
about memory retrieval and reinforcement, learning and memory. Could,
mm-hmm.
could you explain a little bit about that?
Right, so these were two papers from two different labs that were identifying a group of neurons. So in the fly, the site of memory consolidation is the mushroom body. And what these papers were identifying these dopamine-producing neurons.
Can I just ask you, just to explain for me, I mean, mushroom body, what would be the equivalent in humans?
Hippocampus.
Hippocampus.
Yeah. So they identified these dopaminergic neurons that are outside the mushroom body, that project to the mushroom body, that have a role in reinforcing memory. For instance, in one paper, it was it was using this appetitive memory paradigm where the animals are, you know, I'm forgetting aspects of this now, are starved. And they were showing, I think, that the reinforcement of the memory through the food-seeking behavior involved these particular dopaminergic neurons that were outside the mushroom body. And the other group used a different method where they were activating these neurons, and they showed that they could substitute. So in that particular case, I think they were looking at an aversive odor and its effect on memory.
Right.
And what they found was that this particular set of neurons was mediating the effects of the aversive odor. So if they just directly go stimulate those neurons, they get the same effect. Now, I think that it probably wasn't the exact same neurons the two groups were looking at, but they were dopaminergic neurons in the same general cluster.
Yeah, and so this particular one, blocking these dopaminergic neurons releases memory performance in satiated flies.
Right.
Whereas stimulation suppresses memory performance in hungry flies.
Right.
Again, does that have any, saying everything always has to have an application to human beings, but is there anything that we can learn from that that we should know about? About when learning is most useful and what state we should be in when we're trying to...
I don't know about... I mean, certainly that type of memory they do better with when they are starved. And I'm not sure that there's that would apply normally to humans. I guess it is true though that dopamine, for instance, right, is what's involved in like addictive behavior, reward seeking behavior, and that's known in mammals. And so you could kind of stretch this to say, well, likewise in flies, dopamine is involved in memory formation as it relates to reward-seeking behavior or, you know, avoiding aversive condition. I don't know if this...
This may be too early for this particular line of research to actually be very productive at this point. But let me go back to something that you mentioned when we spoke in Seattle. I asked you what are the most profitable lines of inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And you said for sleep research the big questions are the cellular circuitry.
Mm-hmm.
What cells in the brain require to drive
right.
sleep, maintain sleep, what molecules are so.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been... are we driving along in the progress in that direction now? Is there much new to report?
There hasn't been much since we last talked.
Right.
What
since we last talked, what have been the what are the what are the most remarkable things that you have
that I've come across or that we've
done?
Exciting. One of the things that we've actually published since then is how caffeine works to promote wakefulness.
Hmm.
Yeah. So we published that, I think it's September this year.
Right, so that was after we spoke.
Yeah, and it's been thought for many years that the reason caffeine promotes wakefulness is because it's an antagonist of the adenosine receptor. So adenosine is thought to be a sleep-promoting molecule. If you antagonize its receptor, you get wakefulness. And caffeine supposedly does this. We found that in our fly model, the caffeine is acting, it promotes wakefulness just like it does in mammals, but it does not seem to be acting through the adenosine receptor, at least definitely not exclusively. In fact, what seems to be the more relevant caffeine target is phosphodiesterase. So phosphodiesterase, the enzyme that breaks down cyclic AMP, is also a very well-known caffeine target, which had been dismissed by mammalian people because it was thought that the doses at which caffeine was delivered in these studies of animals, it wasn't high enough to inhibit phosphodiesterase. But I think that idea sort of, you know, lost support a few years ago when someone said the effects of caffeine on the immune system are going through phosphodiesterase. So anyway, based upon what we're finding in the fly, I would be a huge advocate of revisiting the whole mechanism of caffeine action.
Okay, but again, I hate to sound like a cracked record here saying what are the implications of this, but I mean, in this particular case,
yes,
as you watch people in the morning in
yes
droves,
yes, yeah,
throwing down the dark,
right,
dark liquid,
right,
where it actually, where it acts,
mm-hmm,
why would that be important? I mean, there was a little clue there where you talked about immune system and so on and so
right
forth.
Right.
So what is it doing and how would the story be changed and what would we need to think about more carefully if the story was changed?
Well, so, I mean, the immune system would be one thing too, right? Although effects of caffeine on the immune system were known prior to this. It was just what was shown was that it actually acted through phosphodiesterase, which would be the same target that we think is relevant for sleep. And so one of the things, that thing that you would have to take into account is that these things are going hand in hand, right? Because if it's the same target that's relevant for the immune system and that's relevant for sleep, then the amount of caffeine you're taking in that's helping you stay awake is having its corresponding effect on the immune system. I don't even remember exactly what that effect is. They're measuring levels of different molecules in the immune system. The other thing is that if it's acting through phosphodiesterase, then any other drug out there that affects phosphodiesterases would have to be viewed in light of its effect on sleep.
So you're also going to, when you're here, you're going to give a talk,
mm-hmm,
at the Salk Institute.
Right.
What are you going to talk about?
Well, I'm going to talk about some of the stuff I talked about at the cell biology meeting today, which is the circadian control of metabolism. And I will talk about the new sleep mutant we isolated, which we did talk about it, Sleepless.
Mm-hmm.
And so we published last year that we isolated the mutant. And since then, we've actually done more work to show how it affects neuronal excitability. And it does it by regulating the Shaker potassium channel.
Okay, we did go through some of that.
Yeah.
There's something I meant to ask you about last time. I went to the...
That paper's in press now, actually.
The website. I'm just looking at this... this photograph of your
lab. That's an old one. It's a really old one.
Is it old?
Yeah.
Has things changed? Because unusually, it seems to me that there are, out of this group here, I counted there were 10 women and 4 males.
Oh, really?
I was thinking about this whole generic issue that we've talked about before about women in science and getting into science.
Yeah.
Is your lab still that way? Is it still pretty, a lot of women going into your lab?
I think it's not quite as slanted as it is in that picture there. So there are more men than there were at the time. Are there more women at this point? Maybe not. Maybe not. But maybe it may be more equivalent right now. But it is true that women's labs tend to have more women in general.
The reason I ask is that I've asked a number of people recently whether I should. I've asked that question about the alleged difficulty of women in science, and saying, I've been saying, should I retire this question? Is it all solved? Is the issue
No, it's not solved at all. It's not solved at all.
And that's what I
keep
on hearing.
It's not solved at all. I mean, even now, it just, you know, women coming into graduate school are represented in equal numbers, but every step after that, they keep falling off. And, you know, at the level of like senior women, there aren't that many. I mean, maybe we talked about this, I don't remember, but for instance, at Penn, where I am, and I think this is true at most places, you know, I end up doing like so much committee work, administrative work, and so forth. And a lot of it is because there are so few senior women, and they need to have us represented on every committee. So the few of us who are there get asked to serve on everything. But that just, you know, is to tell you that at the senior level, there are very few women.
Well, that sounds almost like a self-defeating enterprise there, because if you get so much effort being spent on doing those sorts of things, you're not doing your science.
Right.
It needs to be a reason.
Yeah, but, you know, it's hard. And I think women like to go, like to work for women because, I don't know if they're looking for role models. I don't know if they feel that the women will be more supportive of, you know, issues that might come up relating to family and so forth. I don't know if they just feel more comfortable in that. Maybe they won't be discriminated against in the lab. I don't know, but it could be for any number of reasons. But it is true that if there is, you know, a high concentration of women any place, it will usually be in a place where there's a female boss.
In the car on my when we were coming over, I was talking to you about this question I've been asking a lot of people. The president, when his inaugural address, talked about restoring science to its rightful place.
Right.
And I've been asking people, well, what are the coordinates?
Right.
Like, what is the rightful place of science in a society? The year 2010 coming up, 350th anniversary of the Royal Society, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
What should the place of science be in a society?
Well, I think it should be, I'm not sure exactly how you're thinking about this, but it should be influencing every aspect of government, of life, much more than it has been. It should not be sort of this isolated, you know, thing that some people do. It should really permeate, I think, everybody's life and public policy. So whether it's, you know, global warming, which of course more people are willing to look at in a scientific way, whether it's healthcare, which again, maybe that relates to science much more, but you know, even I think we talked about this last time, even things like what time schools should begin and end, which there's a considerable research on right now as to what would be the right time when it comes to that. And so I think it really needs to be drawn into the mainstream. And I'm not sure how. One of the things obviously that has to be done is that we maybe need to reach out to the public all the time. But I think the other thing that has to be done, and is maybe even more important, is that the government has to recognize that science needs to become more mainstream. And maybe also the basic science education that's required needs to be revisited. Because my sense is that in a lot of, like, you know, top-notch colleges, they will require that students take, you know, the students who are going to major in science have to take some humanities courses. And I think the reverse is not quite true.
Mm-hmm.
Those that are going to do humanities, if they have to take a science class at all, it's like a joke.
Mm-hmm. So that's a good position. I mean, I my argument that give me the front page of a newspaper, I'll point out all the science stories, and people say, well, there aren't any, it's in the science section.
Right. No. That's what I mean by it's all in a separate, it's in a box, you know?
Yeah. It's all over the front page. The things that we've been talking about.
Right.
Talking about the medical bills, people's health, people's diet, their nutrition, metabolism, sleep, education, all of these things are profoundly affected by scientific stories.
Right. In fact, I mean, you could even make the case that maybe there shouldn't be a science section, because in having such a section, you're kind of relegating it to...
Well, unfortunately, that really is happening,
yes.
As you know,
yeah.
Science sections are being cut.
Not because you're putting it elsewhere. Yes.
No. It's just because the assumption is that it's not a winner in terms of getting public interest, which I disagree with, as you know. In terms of the meeting you've just been at, mm-hmm. Society of Cell Biology, were the connections that we were talking about, are they manifest there? Do you have the sense that people think outside their own boxes and make connections like this, or is that more work needs to be done in those sorts of areas? Making connections between different silos.
Making connections across fields. Do you mean connections as in connecting with scientists or actually listening to the science? Because, you know, there are...
I think between the sciences in the sense that... Mm-hmm. In the sense that meetings are often very focused.
Yes.
Which is fine.
Right.
But... then you miss the...
Yes, yes, yeah. So this actually is a great meeting from that point of view. It's the first time that I've come to a cell biology meeting, and what I'm realizing is that it's broad, it's big, you know, as is, you know, the field, cell biology is like that. You know, people doing cell biology in many different systems, and you know, there are neuroscientists, there are immunologists, and so forth. And I think, so just, you know, I guess to give you a more specific example, I co-chaired a session this morning on circadian clocks. And we had several people at that session who said they knew nothing about the field, but had wandered in there just to hear about it. And they asked some really good questions.
Ah, well, that's a good sign.
That is a good sign. And I actually, yes, and I think that this is the kind of meeting that lends itself to something like that.
Yeah, you also mentioned that the keynote,
mm-hmm.
We just did our stem cell meeting here.
Right.
The keynote was Rudy Yanish.
Rudy Yanish, yeah.
Who also gave more of a contexted version, I understand, gave some history.
Yes, he did. He put everything in context. He did a great job. And I thought that was really good because, you know, he went back to the old techniques that they used to use, talked about a time before southern blots existed, and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, it's amazing how fast things are moving.
Yes.
Do you stick by your story here that the next big question is about cellular circuitry, or is there something else that's on the horizon?
Well, certainly, you know, I'm surprised that I didn't say that, but the molecules that control sleep and basically how sleep drive builds up.
Oh, you mentioned that.
Yeah,
well.
That was in there as well.
That was there.
And then, of course, there's a big function of sleep thing, right? Which I think will fall out of all of this.
The fact that we still don't have
answers
to...
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
What do you think about the story that's emerged from Matt Wilson, from Bob Stickgold about...
The replaying of dreams?
About the replaying of dreams. It had a kind of a Francis Crick Graham Mitchison cleaning out the unwanted... stuff and keep good memories.
Well, that's sort of what Giulio Tononi believes.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't know about the replay in the dreams as to whether what the connection is between that and what's actually happening in terms of.
So mm-hmm. the Wilson and Stickgold story would be just a context, of course. How would you describe?
I guess are you talking about where they replay their experiences while awake in their dreams.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, it's nice to relate it to the synaptic changes that are actually taking place, or we think are taking place, but I'm not sure that there's that much connection between them just yet. So for it, I guess what I'm saying is that right at the moment, the jury is still out on whether the replay of the day's events in your dreams contribute to these consolidation of the good memories and throwing out of the others, or whether it just is a simple things you've been through during the day just are things you dream about. But
just give me a very brief capsule description of what you'll be talking about tomorrow.
Right, so the metabolic stuff is, I think I told you about it already, the neuronal and fat body clocks and how they regulate metabolism and feeding. And the sleep stuff would be describing the meal mood, but then focusing more on our more recent stuff, which is showing that the sleepless protein acts in a cell autonomous manner, so it acts within the same cell that it's produced in to regulate the activity of the shaker potassium channel. And we believe that this is what accounts for the effect of the sleepless gene on sleep. And so we actually show that these two proteins interact directly, and their expression in the fly brain also overlaps.
So let's try and meet again in another few months and see how far we've gone.
Okay.
Solve the problem of sleep and meet us again. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.